Welcome to Berlin Briefing. Today, we want to give you a clear understanding what might happen if the far-right AfD comes to real power in Germany. And I brought something along for you. Take a look, if you can. We have some graphics for you. Let it sink in. And for those who can't see it, just listening, we have a graphic of what people would vote for if the federal election were held next Sunday and the AfD comes in with 28%, which is 6% more than the center-right CDU-CSU that is also governing in a coalition in Germany right now. And if you look at this, you might ask yourself, with polls like this, why isn't the AfD in power yet? And that's part of what you will understand if you stick with us. And I have guests here in the studio, great guests, of course. My in-house guests, our in-house expert is Matthew Moore. He just came back from an interview with a prominent figure of the AfD. And also with us is Katja Hoyer, who is a renowned historian. And she has a new book out, Weimar, Life on the Edge of Catastrophe. Pretty fitting or not, we'll find out. Anyway, Matt, with numbers like the one we just saw, with polls like this, what does the AfD have to show for as far as executive power goes?
Not a lot, actually. You know, this is a party that in its 13 years of existence has managed to gain a presence in all the state parliaments in Germany, has managed to gain a presence in the European Parliament. But when you look at executive power, they've only got, I think, two or three really small town mayors in eastern Germany, not much more. And that's in a system where you have coalitions, that, you know, it's a pluralist system where you have parties that work together. And so it's quite unusual, I think, for a party to have something like 20-odd% in polls in state elections across the country and still not have anything really to show for it. Mm. And that's part of the problem. And there is a bit of frustration within the party about that. But obviously, the message they're sending in now is, look, there's dysfunction everywhere, and we're the only answer.
Mm. And Katja, if you're the AfD, maybe, you know, put yourself in their shoes. What are your options in a situation like this one?
Well, the debate seems to be internally whether or not they should work towards being a viable coalition partner with the Conservatives, or whether they should stay on their own course, quite radical, and try and work towards the idea of being the only party in power, which is quite difficult with Germany's election system. But that's ultimately what they have to decide. Do they stay true to their course and stay quite radical, or do they moderate and become possibly a coalition partner for the Conservatives?
So basically the options are either stay the course and try to get an absolute majority so you don't need a coalition partner, or try to be more moderate to convince other parties to cooperate with you, right?
Yes, that seems to be internally the debate, whether they should go for that. But then you risk alienating voters in that moment when you say, actually, we're becoming more like the mainstream parties. Then some of their voters will say, well, what's the point? I might as well go back to the Conservatives.
And of course, in Germany, we don't just have federal elections. We also have elections on the state level. And one of them is coming up, I think, 6th of September in Saxony-Anhalt, small eastern state. And the AfD, according to the polls at least, has a real shot of getting an absolute majority there. We also have something you could take a look at polling-wise. So opinion polls in Saxony-Anhalt, let it sink in again. AfD polling at 41%. That's a very pretty new poll, May 7th, right there, in the CDU, CSU, so the center-right coming in at 26%. So in the polls, at least, that is a huge gap. And to our users, be interested in seeing your comments. You know, what do you make of that? We're going to try to make this picture clearer here. And if you look at that, Matt, and I think our users are also asking themselves probably, if you look at those numbers, how can it be that the AfD actually doesn't have any real power yet? True?
Well, the thing is, you know, you need that plus, you need more than 50%. You need more than half of the votes. And they're at 41%. It's a majority, but it's not an absolute majority. Now, the German system has this 5% rule. So if parties come under 5%, they don't actually enter to the parliament, and those votes essentially are wasted votes, you know, so they're not represented, those voters are not represented by parties in parliament. It also means that depending on how many parties don't get into parliament, you don't need 50% of the vote. You can get in with 43, 44%. And that is why the AfD is at the moment is in a very confident position, because it's not like they're sitting there on 41 thinking we need 10% more. They could sneak in with an absolute majority if they just get 43, 44%. And so that's the aim at the moment. Look, there are all sorts of... There's 3 months to go, so anything can happen. But that's their aim at the moment. And we will see. The other problem is that it's... If you look at those numbers, there's not many options for an alternative government in Saxony-Anhalt.
Yeah, because it's hard to get a majority against the without the AfD. Yeah. But if you look at those numbers and people say, hey, okay, this is clear. If they don't make it this time, they'll make it the next time, because the numbers just keep going up and up and up and up. Is that something that, in your observation, is a realistic assessment?
It's so difficult to say, Max, because, you know, you've got so many different factors. I think a lot of it depends on the economy in this country. If the economy starts to change, that affects the mood in the country. The AfD would like people to think that it's inevitable. That's the message they want to send. It's why you hear them every time. You know, they're pounding the government whenever there's a little bit of bad economic data. We're the only alternative. But when you look at those numbers, there's still 60-odd% of people in this state who are rejecting the AfD despite everything. So I think it's really hard to say. A lot will depend on whether or not a viable government emerges in this state. And also whether the AfD, if they do win power, what they do with that power, whether they can show it, prove it to be a success.
All right. Katja, why won't other parties work with the AfD?
Well, there's this concept of a firewall that is used in German politics, whereby basically the other parties say, we're not forming a coalition with the AfD because of German history, largely. So the argument is that because of Germany's Nazi past, that there shouldn't be a party kind of right of conservatism that's that extreme and radical in parts of it and relevant parts of it. And so there's, I would say, perhaps more of a consciousness of that in Germany. I mean, other countries have tried different things, like the cordon sanitaire in France, for example, where there is a rough equivalent of that. But the line seems to be harder in Germany, I think, because of its own past. So most parties don't want to be seen to even be thinking about that, because they fear that the electorate and also their own supporters, their own party members, that they would find that this is a taboo that can't be broken.
In your research for your books and generally in your experience, are numbers like the ones we just saw reliable? You know, is this what then actually happens, or do people change their behavior and their vote when they're standing in the voting booth?
I mean, Saxony-Anhalt is an interesting example there, because there has been a situation before at the last election where the AfD looked like they were going to win by a country mile, and then actually on the day that didn't happen, the CDU won it again. But that was very, very based on the individual people running for office. So if people, especially at state level, when it's not basically for the federal government, but in the individual states, there's always a strong emphasis in German politics on the actual people running for office. I mean, sometimes people refer to the minister president of each state as the Landesvater, the sort of father of the state. There's this very much a feeling there that it depends on the personality, and that isn't the same anymore, because the previously the incumbent holder of that office, Haseloff, has removed himself from that office and handed over basically to a candidate that is perhaps less well known in the state and hasn't got the same, I would say, charisma. And
Schulze. Yeah, that's his name. By the way, though, interesting fact, he's polling above the AfD lead candidate in the state, although the AfD is ahead as a party, but the most favored candidate at the moment is Sven Schulze, who's the candidate of the center-right CDU-CSU. Let's talk about what the AfD really wants. The goal is to give you an understanding if there's a difference between what the AfD says and what it'll actually do later. There might be a big difference there, something we'll try to figure out here. Matt, you talked to Uli Siegmund, who is the lead candidate of the AfD in Saxony-Anhalt, just a day before we recorded it, so in the past you would have said fresh off the press. What's your main takeaway from that interview?
He's incredibly confident right now because of polling numbers, because of the mood in the state and the sense of frustration. And he's feeling a sense of changes in the wind, really. And he said, you know, to me that he's obviously not counting his chickens before the eggs have hatched, etc. But he's confident. He also, you know, I was interested because he's not, this is not a party that's saying, you know, this is broken, and we're going to make sure that kids are back in school classes again, and that the hospitals are getting fixed. This is a party that's talking about root and branch change. You know, this is their manifesto for this state. It's hundreds of pages long. They want to really change, get at the kind of the root of the problem, and this was not
from their perspective.
Yeah,
right.
And so it's not just like tackling the symptoms, but the causes. Mm. And that, I think, will present, if he does win power, that will present a massive shock to German voters and to Germany, really, I think.
You brought us a soundbite. Probably just should listen in first, and we'll talk about it.
There's a real sense of optimism here in Saxony-Anhalt. It's a wonderful feeling. We find ourselves in a historic moment. We want nothing more and nothing less than to make history. We want to restore institutions to a path of success, depoliticized, neutral, and serving the country.
He's a young guy, 34?
35.
Yeah. What does he mean when he's talking about that in German, Apparate?
Yeah, so we talked about his plans to change ministries, to bring in new civil servants. Now, if they win power, they would have to find hundreds of new staffers to fill jobs, in advisory jobs, consultants and so on. But one of the issues that people are concerned about is what he might do with the Interior Ministry and the security services. And from his point of view and from his party's point of view, the security services have been persecuting his party. And so he's clearly saying to me there yesterday, we are going to tackle that head on when we get into power. And that would present a massive issue, not just locally, because this is an organisation, the Office for the Protection of the Constitution, Domestic Security Service, that is monitoring his party and deems him a right-wing extremist, but then he would be in charge of it. It's also an issue because that organisation, the office, the local office, obviously shares information with other offices in other states and has access to a lot of classified information. And so a lot of interior ministers in the country are now raising concerns about what that would mean.
And we're going to take a closer look at that later in the podcast, so stick with us. Very interesting part, of course, of the whole discussion. Before we get there, though, Katja, I would like to ask you, is this a case of what you see is what you get? You know, what he says, that's what he's going to do if they really do get an absolute majority? Or do you anticipate the AfD moving more to the center if they actually have the power, because it's a different role, you know, no longer opposition? Or might they even go even further to the right?
It's quite hard to tell because they are having internal debates about that as well. So it's difficult to see exactly which faction, which group within the AfD will come to the fore in the individual states themselves. You've got different groups. So it's not really, I think, predictable, really, who's going to be in charge and what they're going to do as such. And the other thing to bear in mind is that there are other structures other than the parties and the government. So you do have courts, you have certain procedures, you know, how judges are appointed, that kind of thing. Mm. We just talked about the Domestic Security Service, which has got its own role to play. So they can't from one day to the next change the entire system, because it's designed to have kind of safeguards against that internally. So when Germany was sort of reset in 1949, it looked at the Weimar constitution of the interwar period and was trying to fix all the little loopholes, the gaps that could potentially be exploited by parties who want to change the entire system, kind of root and branch. And so it might be tricky to do some of the things that they want to do, because, you know, other institutions might block that.
And that's part of your book, obviously, too, your new book, right? That's where you explore those questions also with the Weimar Republic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are obviously similarities. I wouldn't draw a straight line there because it's a very different time that we're talking about. The 1920s are not the 2020s. But there are certainly, in the way that we're seeing a fracturing of the political landscape, so the you know, we just talked about the fact that it becomes increasingly difficult to actually form a coalition and run the state. When you have sort of three, four parties working together, you get, you know, we see this already in German politics to a point where the parties want different things, so they end up either doing nothing or the lowest common denominator. People get then even more frustrated and turn to other parties, and that dynamic, I would say, isn't dissimilar.
Matt, is there any evidence that there's a difference between the official goals that the AfD has that are written down in the party program and hidden goals? Are there hidden goals, you know, something that is unsaid but some people at least think they will do?
This will be the subject of court cases in the next months and years, actually. On paper, the party says we will do everything by the book. We are a party that believes in the rule of law. But you have to also look at who the party people, the more radical wing of the party, who they associate with. Ulrich Siegmund, the man that I interviewed yesterday, has links with organizations like the Identitarian Movement. He took part in the famous Potsdam meeting. This was a meeting a couple of years ago with Martin Senner. Saw hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, go to the streets. And that the reason was...
A prominent figure in the Identitarian Movement from Austria.
Yeah, and he's a white supremacist. He would call himself an ethno-pluralist nowadays. Essentially, wants to restore Europe to its white roots. But ultimately, the reason that meeting was controversial was because they discussed remigration, which, from Martin Senna's concept, is about making life difficult for German citizens with migration background who haven't assimilated. Now, the AfD says that our concept of remigration is a different one. We wouldn't do that because they know it's anti-constitutional. But people would still expect someone like Siegmund to distance himself from that and say, look, that's absolutely not ours. Maybe we shouldn't use the word. There are people within the AfD who think that this is very damaging. And so this is where the line is blurred. What do they mean by remigration? Mm. Is it really about making life difficult for German citizens and trying to get them to return to their ancestral homes? Or is it, as they say it is, something that would be completely above board and it's about following the laws of the land?
Some politicians, Katja, also draw or see comparisons. Obviously not politicians from the AfD, but they see comparisons or draw comparisons between parts of AfD rhetoric of some politicians of the AfD and the Nazi era in Germany. Is that legitimate?
I'm always a bit cautious about that because people forget how much a part violence played in the rise of the Nazi Party, and whatever the AfD is right now, it hasn't got 4 million, you know, sort of SA stormtroopers on the streets that are beating up and murdering political opponents or intimidating them. So to me, the perhaps optimistic message there is that this is a political battle that we're fighting today. It's not the street battles of the Weimar Republic, whereby, you know, the actual intimidation played a huge role. So even if Hitler hadn't been as successful as he was at the ballot box in that he got not even a majority, but many people voting for him, you still had that option, basically, to go to a coup sort of scenario, if in doubt, because he basically had more men at his hands than the state did. So that is a completely different situation today, I would say. Nonetheless, you would expect from a German right-wing party that, because they're German and right-wing, that they draw a very, very clear line between themselves and that past and say, no, we're not this. And yet you get constant, you know, sort of incidences where individual AfD members or politicians use rhetoric that's reminiscent of that time. There's a case recently where someone from the AfD is being investigated for doing the Hitler salute, clicking his heels in parliament, that kind of thing. So you would expect there to be a little bit more caution from individual members. And there are many people in the AfD who feel that that's the way to go, so that you should draw a line there and you should be clear about that. But there are also plenty of people who don't. And that, I think, is something worth taking note of.
And it's important to remember, Matt already said so, but just to be very clear, in this discussion, the regional AfD branch in Saxony-Anhalt, among others, by the way, has been classified as certified extreme right by the intelligence agency of that state, so of Saxony-Anhalt. I know from people in the U.S. that despite what we discussed, they think it's undemocratic to deny a democratically elected party access to government coalitions. That's a feedback we often get here. Let's find out whether this argument is actually legitimate in the context that we discussed, you know, being in Germany, for example. Is what we're seeing unfold, Katja, the AfD being strong but not having real executive power, the way German democracy is supposed to work?
Well, people are certainly getting frustrated with it. So when you look at polling figures and people are asked, you know, do you support democracy in principle? You get an overwhelming majority of people saying absolutely, almost everyone, basically. It's very high figures. But when you ask them, are you happy with the way that democracy is working right now, then you get people being frustrated about the kind of practicalities of it, because ultimately, if you look at the state of Thuringia, for example, where the AfD did come first in the last state elections, but it's not in power right now. Basically, you have the next parties up all forming a coalition together because they're saying we're not having a coalition with the AfD. And you go to Thuringia today and ask people about that, they say, well, we voted for something, we're not getting it. You know, how is that democracy? So this is a real dilemma for German politics right now, that you end up in a situation where the single largest party is out of power permanently and people are getting frustrated with this and vote for them in even higher numbers the next time around. And that seems to have been the trend so far. I mean, there will be a cap basically at one point where we've already seen so far that an outright majority doesn't seem to be on the cards in terms of kind of over 50% of voters going there. But nonetheless, you know, the tactic of trying to exclude them from any kind of discourse also doesn't seem to have worked in diminishing their appeal to people.
But isn't German democracy designed to prevent extreme parties from the left or the right? So why is the AfD allowed to operate?
I mean, the ultimate nuclear option would be a party ban. So if it's found in terms of, you know, the legal requirements that they are that extreme, that they kind of fulfill the very, very strict criteria for a party ban, then that would be an option that's been done before in West German politics. The two political parties were banned in the 1950s by the then Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. One far right, one far left. So there is a precedent, but these two parties were very small. So to now go and say the largest, you know, according to polling right now, the largest and most popular political party will get banned seems a difficult thing to do. How much democracy do you have left when you defend it from the people at the ballot box?
And actually, the AfD itself, of course, would argue. I think they're not extreme.
Yeah, and remember that they're a suspected case. At the national level, this is where it gets a bit complicated. At the national level, the party is a suspected case of right-wing extremism, which is essentially the Office for the Protection of the Constitution, which is a very unique idea, really, that it's basically an office, an agency that is independent of the Interior Ministry here in Germany, that its job essentially is to monitor threats to the Constitution. You don't have that in the UK, where I grew up. And just to raise the alarm if we see any problems. And they've raised the alarm, and there's various stages and levels that they can do that. And they began a few years ago and said, we think that the AfD is a suspected case of right-wing extremism, i.e. we think it may have anti-constitutional aims. Obviously, the AfD rejected that, went to court. It went to court, and the courts found in the Office for the Protection of the Constitution's favour and said there's evidence that some parts of this party do have anti-constitutional aims, but they're not quite sure whether it's the whole party, but you are allowed to investigate them, spy on them if necessary. And then obviously last year, Max, in May, you'll remember, the Office for the Protection of the Constitution said, we believe they are confirmed right-wing extremist endeavour. Huge backlash. The US Secretary of State got involved, JD Vance got involved. That went to court, is now going through the courts in an interim injunction. They've said, look, don't use that label just yet. It needs to go through the courts completely. And then we will see whether that holds up in court. But until then, there is really no grounds, political grounds, to say we can't have a ban. And then you've got, what, as Katja said, you know, whether a ban would even work and whether that may only strengthen the party.
And I mean, there was a slight setback, at least that's how it was interpreted this year, I believe.
In February, there was an interim. There was an interim injunction, which basically just, they said, don't use the label. But the Office for the Protection of the Constitution had already said, we're not going to use the label. But they also said, actually, in that ruling, parts of the party clearly have, there's evidence that they have anti-constitutional aims. We're not sure that there's enough evidence that the whole party is characterised by that. And that's where, as we've been touching on, parts of the party, but does the whole party have that aim? How do you prove it? Doesn't necessarily need to be something that's written down, right? It can be things that they say in speeches over and over and over again.
But the, within the AFD, this was interpreted as a setback for the proponents of a ban, correct?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, of course, it is a setback. But the court case will be much longer, and much more evidence will be poured over, and it will take a long time. And there is not, it's no guarantee that it will go one way or the other. I don't think.
Okay, we've laid the foundations in this discussion. Now let's get to the heart of the matter, which is, if you want to know what the AFD actually will do, because we don't have crystal balls here, but what they actually can do, it's time to listen closely. And Katja, I want to start with you. On a state level, if they do get an absolute majority, what are the AFD's most powerful tools in Saxony and how to pursue its goals?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that this is one state.
A small state.
So in that sense, they can't affect anything that is federal policy. So say, for example, foreign policy, they do have a very different view on, for example, the war in Ukraine, and where parts of the party are kind of very far more, they would say, pacifist, and they would say it's about diplomacy. But there are also plenty of people in there who travel to Russia on a regular basis and have a different outlook. So that is something that's quite difficult to affect from a state-level point of view, because foreign policy is in the hands of the federal government, as is immigration to a large extent, although the individual rules on deportations and things like that, quite often that's actually enacted by the state rather than the federal system. So there's a bit of a blurry zone there. What is in state hands, though, is things like policing, education, culture, and they've already set out some pretty robust, drastic policies there. So, for example, in terms of what do you actually do with Germany's memory culture in terms of its own past, you know, museums and memorials have a huge role to play there. There's already been a sort of semi-culture war over the legacy of the Bauhaus, for example. So this modernist art and architecture movement that started off in Weimar, but then basically set up in Dessau, which is in Saxony-Anhalt. And that's one of the bones of contention for the AfD in Saxony-Anhalt, that they feel that this role of the Bauhaus in the state's memory is sort of overblown and it needs to be done in a different way. So those things they can affect by giving money or not to certain institutions, setting up new ones. Education, I mean, they could change the curriculum if they wanted to in Saxony-Anhalt.
They want to. That's what he told me yesterday. You know, that was one of the things. And that's what I thought was interesting, is that it's not just about saying, okay, schools are decrepit and we need to make sure that teachers, there's too many hours of tuition that are falling out and kids are sitting around. They really want to change the curriculum because they think the curriculum has gone, in their mind, woke and has lost its way.
And is there one example you could pinpoint to give us a sense of what that would mean?
Well, firstly, I mean, they want to do something which is fairly radical for Germany, and that is to abolish the compulsory schooling law, which essentially means that the people can do homeschooling in Germany or in Saxony.
But like in the United States.
In the United States, perfectly normal. And most people would be saying, oh, well, I mean, each to their own, as you will. But in Germany, that's a fairly controversial plan. And then the other thing they want to do is to, you talked about it, this remembrance culture. In Germany, it's commonplace for students to go to former concentration camps to learn about the history of the Holocaust. The AfD and Ulrich Siegmund wants to change the focus. They want to defund an organisation that organises these trips in Saxony-Anhalt. And I asked him about it and he said, well, we think that the focus needs to be much more broader We need to be, look at the positive aspects of German history. But for other people, especially people involved in this sector, they're saying this is concerning to us because we think this is essentially a sleight of hand to shift the focus away, to make it so that people don't feel so kind of afraid of the past.
And we actually, you brought us a soundbite where Ulrich Siegmund explains some of the things he wants to do if he does come into power with the AfD, needs an absolute majority. Just want to remind everybody of that. Let's listen in.
We don't want to tinker with the symptoms. We want to address the root causes. And that's why we want to take the first step in freeing people from the compulsory public broadcasting fee. We want to withdraw from the state media treaty. And the second is a complete reversal in migration policy. Many people here in Saxony-Anhalt simply no longer recognize their own homeland.
So talking about public broadcasters that are a very important part of the media landscape in Germany, talking about migration, could you put this into context for us, Katja?
Yeah, so with the what Ami was just talking about there with the contracts for public broadcasters, they're basically a part of that is at state level. So you do have regional TV, for example, and things like that. And when he's saying they want to effectively cancel the contract, then that means that you have a very, very basic, I think that's the idea, that they just have a basic coverage of some news and things, but you don't get, say, documentaries and more expensive forms of kind of public broadcasting and TV. So that's a very different media landscape. You end up basically with an entirely private, more or less, media sector. They're not alone in that. There's some criticism, I think, from conservative parties as well of the who feel that the public sort of broadcasting sector has become too left-wing or too woke, as they might say. And so that's something that a lot of people feel quite strongly about and is perhaps one of their stronger selling points to people in Saxony-Anhalt as well. And on migration, it's a tricky thing because that is largely, I mean, the overall migration policy is down to the federal government. But as I say, at local level, they certainly have power over things like deportations and also over how to distribute, for example, migrants who come in. So where you put the refugee centres, how much money do you spend on things like integration policies, language courses, that kind of thing.
But I was going to talk about that too. We talked about the state level right now. But we're always kind of getting to the point where we say this is not a matter of the state. This is a matter of the federal mm-hmm. government. But they could still influence what's happening on the national level. How?
Yeah, so Germany has got basically an upper and a lower chamber in its system. And so there is an element of the individual states having an impact on the passing of laws. So once you have AfD people in there and larger numbers, basically they can block things, for example, that should normally go through the legislative process. So that is one way of doing that. And the other thing to bear in mind is that they're setting an example here, aren't they? If they say they get one state, they have to sort of show that they can do things and that they can talk about the big topics that concern their voters. Migration and immigration is certainly the most important thing to AfD voters. So they can't just say, oh, this isn't our business, you know, let's not talk about this. They have to show that this is something that they will do something about if they were elected in other places as well. So Saxony-Anhalt would have effectively become like a sort of, you know, test state, really, where people can see what they would do. And so they have to try and tackle these big issues as well.
One of the aspects of it as well is that it's about where you place refugee asylum centres. And, you know, they've promised to do it in places where they're out of sight, that they're kind of uncomfortable for the residents of these centres. The other thing he talked to me about yesterday was means testing the help, the benefits that asylum seekers are getting, because he feels that many of them are coming to Germany and have assets and wealth, and he wants to tap into that. It's obviously bureaucratic. It's obviously there's all sorts of arguments maybe why you wouldn't do that, but it's about this sense of people are getting something for nothing, and we're gonna tackle that sense of injustice that maybe the voters feel. Another aspect is that there's a quota and states have to take their quota of asylum seekers, and he and the AfD have said if they win power in this state, they would not accept asylum seekers and they would break from that quota. And that is one area where it would cause a headache for the states, and it would be a sign of, look, we do have power now, and to voters, you know, that your vote is counts, their vote matters.
Does this remind you of anything you've seen in other countries?
Well, I think the thing that we've kind of touched on briefly is this idea of, okay, what happens when you're in power? Okay, passing laws and whole-scale changes is a slow process, but the AFD is clear that they would want to put people in positions of power, whether it's at the head of the Office for the Protection of the Constitution or the police, the security services, who they think align with their policies.
But doesn't every party do that?
Exactly, right? Every party does it, but they would be looking at places like in Hungary or Poland, where they managed to place judges who are favourable to them. And I think they're already thinking about these questions now. And there's conversations going on. There's within the AFD in Berlin here, who can we find? What kind of candidates can we find that can fill certain jobs for us? Who can we put forward? Who can we suggest that maybe the other parties in the Sachsen-Anhalt government will vote for to be a constitutional judge in the state circuit there? So all sorts of questions that they're looking to try and address to, in their mind, correct what they think is decades of the system not functioning as it should.
And, of course, with other parties, there would be strong disagreement about that assessment. I want to get briefly back to something we touched upon, Katja, before. Having listened to all this, also the obligations of governing on a state level, the obligations that you have as a state government on the national level, not just possibilities to influence, but also obligations. Do you, hypothetical, right, if the AfD really were to get an absolute majority in Saxony-Anhalt, do you anticipate the AfD changing the realities of governing, or the realities of governing changing the AfD?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, is what will actually happen, because ultimately the system exists as is for now. And they'd have to find a way of working with that. And that this is something that has frustrated other parties before, where they've tried to put change in and then either you find that there are legal obstacles or the actual process doesn't work that way. And you have to sort of find ways of working around that. And that often means getting down to the nitty gritty of which bits of your law can you actually enact and which ones you can't. And this is part of what makes voters feel frustrated, is that say for example right now at the national level, where you have a coalition of the Conservative CDU CSU with the centre left SPD, and voters expect change, and they find that at every level they propose something and then they talk about it and it gets smaller and smaller, and you come up with something that's more of a tweak than a root and branch reform. And the AfD says it's
called compromise,
which for the AfD is an ugly, ugly word, you know. And we've talked about it. There's people.
What's that?
Compromise is a very ugly word for the AfD. You know, there's a real premium placed on we are going to stick to our guns. Leading figures in the AfD talk about, you know, are asked about what would you do if the melanization of the party. This is the kind of the Italian prime minister, you know, that she's kind of seen as having kind of moderated in power, and they're saying absolutely not with us. And this is the big battle actually within the party that's coming down the line, should they enter power, is really whether or not they stick to their guns or whether they compromise.
Yeah, and if once you get there and you start just tweaking rather than reforming yourself, then ultimately voters will sort of think, well, that wasn't really the point. I mean, we voted for you because you said there was going to be big change. So they would really be under pressure to deliver that quickly. And at the moment, one of their big problems, I mean, you hinted at this earlier, is personnel. They don't even have enough people necessarily. You know, you'd have to sort of, especially in Saxony-Anhalt, if they actually get a majority, suddenly you need, you know, people to fill all these positions. So there's a question there, do they draw their best, their most competent people from all over the country? And if so, they're missing somewhere else, aren't they? So there's even the functioning of government might be an issue on a day-to-day basis. That's not to say that other parties should just think, you know, this is all going to go wrong once they're in power and let them have it and, you know, let's just see how it works out. I think that's naive as well to think that nothing would change. But it's certainly, I think, a big unknown right now what it actually means if they were in power.
We need to kind of wrap it up. There's one question that wasn't really, you know, that's not the goal of today's question, but I think it kind of swings in the background of everything we've said. So don't want to go into detail, but just get your analysis of, with all the work you've done, both of you, right? Can you make our users, our viewers, understand in a very short way, why people intend, so many people intend to vote for the AfD?
I think in a nutshell, it's the fact that they want change and they feel they're not getting it. There's a sense that it doesn't matter anymore which party you vote for. You're going to get a coalition of the same two or three parties, maybe in slightly different proportions, but ultimately it works out as the same thing as far as AfD voters are concerned. So they basically look at that and say, we need to break this, you know, if necessary, with a sledgehammer. And that's why you get a lot of people, you know, you mentioned earlier that in some instances, the leaders aren't all that popular. They're less popular than the actual party. And I think whilst that's not a sign that this is a protest vote as such, I'm not necessarily sure that the majority of people, I think it's moved on from that, that they do want what the AfD says it will do. But nonetheless, it's mostly about trying to find, you know, literally an alternative to what's there. And that's why the name of the AfD itself being the alternative for Germany is playing onto that idea that there is a different way of doing things. So that, I would say, is the main driver behind this.
Can't argue with any of that.
You agree?
Yeah, because I agree with that. And I think as well, I do think that there's no, it's not a surprise that the AfD is so strong in East Germany, where net wealth is much, much lower in East Germany than it is in West Germany. And I think the sense of vulnerability plays a big role, that people think, I don't feel secure, the economy is not booming, there's change in the air, and jobs are kind of being lost every week, new job numbers. And I think that fuels this sense of concern and anxiety that voters have. And they look around and they're looking at the coalition and they're thinking, and the people in power, and they're thinking, they've not got it yet. They've not understood that we're worried here, that we're panicking. And then there's a party that's saying, we get it, and we're going to do X, Y, Z constantly, because they're basically in campaign mode permanently. You know, that's the beauty of being in opposition and not having executive power, is that they are constantly in campaign mode, talking to voters and saying that we understand you and this is what we'll do. And I think that combined with the economy is for the AfD, is a perfect combination.
And it's certainly something we'll talk about in the future more with the state elections coming closer. For now, thank you, Katja, for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt, for being here. Very interesting insights. And thank you also for sticking with us till the end of this podcast, and hope to see you soon again. Don't forget to check us out on the digital platforms, on our website, and leave some comments. We would like to hear what you have to say about this topic we discussed today.